what we were talking about leading up to today were some of the crisis things that cultures like Papua New Guinea find themselves in. And yesterday, we briefly touched on valuable things, values in a culture that make things work. And we talked about community, which was people and their relationships to each other, people not only who are living, but people who have died and who are very much a part of the community today because they influence the way people operate. Exchange, reciprocity, giving and taking of things, especially in forms of agricultural things, marriage, all of the ways that people interact, relationships, very important in Papua New Guinea. And we talked about things that are valuable in terms of pigs, land, material kind of things. And we tried to compare them a bit to maybe the way we see things in our own culture here in America. One thing that we find missing on this list from traditional values that today, that makes a big difference, the way people live and the way they operate in their cultures, is what? What is something you see that's missing out of those traditional values that would have a real impact on cultures in the 20th century period of time that we're living today? What's missing in that list?
Religion.
Well, I guess that we could say that religion kind of is woven in all of that, but there's something else that's missing from what we might see as a value and that isn't in that traditional list that really gives people a headache. Big word. Something that wasn't a part of the real traditional way of life.
Stress?
Could you get those? Because you can't really see them.
It's community, exchange, reciprocity, valuables. You're getting there, and it's something that produces stress. And I'll make it brief so I don't... This big word
money.
Here. Money. Money, which... What we said about all of these things with community is that traditionally people live to benefit and help each other and lift each other up. Money, as it entered into the value system, tends to become not a community-oriented thing, but it becomes more related to the individual. And it produces a lot of difficulty in how people see their handling of this thing we call money. And it produces a lot of problems. The videotape we showed the other day, as we began the sessions, I think Paula and I would have said it's kind of a sensitive and a reflective video that talks about the experiences of an explorer, a patrol officer of the Australian government, who really had a concern and a deep love for people and their relationships. Tonight we're going to see a video that plays a little different song about that same thing, a little harder way that people looked at things. I think, going to be something that you'll find to be interesting. Paula, anything that you need?
No, I think the video itself is just, we're using it as a contrast to what the other video showed. It's the same era. These people work together with each other too. The explorer and that you saw in the other video and the explorers that you'll see in this video as well. They were friends, but they approached things very differently. And as in any country, you're going to have different ways of moving into new cultures. And we just wanted to show you some of the differences that helped to form the country that it is today. And it may explain some of the reasons for some of the conflicts in that we have today. We're human beings. Just a sec. Maybe I should say in this too, there will sometimes be subhead captions in English when people speak another language. The most prominent language you'll see is the Melanesian Pidgin language. You'll be able to hear it. And this is the kind of bridge between all the different language groups in the country. So be aware there'll be interspersed subheadings, subtitles.
Good point. All right. If it gets too loud, let me know.
Well, I was in here, I was young, and I was about pretty thick in the skull. together in the first place with malaria and all kinds of things. But anyhow, when I got there, I went there, and I didn't think I was going to stay there very long because I didn't like it. I got the fever, and I didn't like climbing mountains and wasn't particularly mad about the people. But anyhow, I stayed there. And when I stayed there for the benefit of James Levy Lay. And I didn't do too badly for him. But I stayed there for 50 years.
When the Gold Rush broke out in New Guinea, and Mick left Australia to come to the Gold Rush, I had just left school, and was there. It was in the middle of the depression, and I had got a job up in North Queensland working on a dairy farm. Well, my only thoughts from then, after I learnt that Mick had gone and the Gold Rush, was to get to New Guinea and be doing the same things as Mick was doing. A lot of people say that Mick had the Gold Fever. Well, we all had it. So you can imagine what terrific excitement it was that I was at last almost on my way to the promised land.
When we got into the real new country, we
used to hear them on the top of these hills, singing out for people ahead. And then you'd hear it much further away on another hillside, being repeated. Watching you come and be on a little hill in some place, on top of a gully or something. And they see that we weren't the enemy coming out, that we were different, absolutely different.
Subtitles might be a bit hard to read, huh? Can everybody read them all right?
Not really.
No, or is it okay? Let me just we'll get on to them. I'll just say what they're doing. Talking about what the women can't do or can't do when all of these people come. What this part of it gets to be about is what they're trying to explain. It's very what should I say, as people came, it was mostly the men who were around. And there was a kind of a concern to keep the women out of here. And this is partly what the men are trying to explain about why these people are there. So this is what is kind of happening at this point.
Before that, they were talking about the spirits, that they thought the white people were spirits, people who'd returned from the dead, some of their ancestors before, and their white color was because they had died and were returning. And that's also the other reason why they don't want the women there, because something could happen to them, and that would mean the end of the society without their women.
It would destroy their fertility. And we saw that in the video on Monday as well, that was a concern. But there's a different, we'll get on with this one. Any questions about what we've seen so far while I've stopped? Is there anything that isn't with?
It seemed like some of those Australians need subtitles too.
Yes, well, down under.
Down under.
It took us a few years to pick that up. But that's true. You're picking them up all right, those,
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So much,
so.
Yeah.
Right.
A different way.
Yeah, it takes a while. This has a certain range to it, and that's where...
What would you say about it? I think you know what I'm saying. I know what I'm saying.
Just should say that Papua New Guineans are very much people of the earth. They're not afraid to talk about the things that sexuality and all of these things about the body and how things work are very much a part of life. It's not something that you just discuss in certain areas. They're very, at least were, and this is maybe again different changes, but they're willing to talk about what is the real part of life, and that's what's happening right there.
You have these hundreds and more around you all day, yelling and shouting and rushing up and down. And sometimes I used to feel that 4 or 5 hairs go out of the back of my leg, and I'd look around and the fellow would be wrapping up on the banana leaf. Sometimes it's even pitching the hair out of the dog's back. Or anything that we touch, even if it's fat along the road, they'd be stampeding together. On several occasions, we'd come into a village, and all of a sudden there'd be a woman rushing and grabbed one of the armed boys we had with us. Apparently, he had a very strong resemblance to her son that had been killed in one of the tribal wars. It looked as though she was dead sure that it was her son that had come back. Well, she thought it was her son appearing back from the dead. In the beginning, they thought that we were spirits that had brought these people back. We couldn't speak to the people, and it was very hard to get away from that village.
They said, stay here, when anything that you want, you can have. We said, oh no, we don't want to stay in one place, we're looking for cattle.
When you leave the Mary, they're still weeping, and we just move on then to the next place. They wouldn't follow us very far. In some cases, they wouldn't be able to follow us very far on account of the boundaries. You know, it might be the enemy country further on. We used to look for a campsite about 12 o'clock because in the afternoon, we usually get the afternoon rains, and we'd like to have our camp and everything up before the rains came. Well, by the time we had the camp up and everything went up, there was a huge lot of people around. And of course, we had our boys that used to buy the food.
The pity me for a machine, so, oh, you probably got this in me to show you something, so you probably got this in piggy cat. Me for a machine, pigorese, no, I'm going to kiss him. Oh, Johnny, no, kiss him. What for a pity, mama? Ele quis me dar. Ou ele quis me dar. Ou ele vou que me come. Ou ele vou que me... Quis me cal. Ou ele quis me dar. And Mipra, five na, five no kiri kiri, na pini five no kuno kuno, na kuno kiri na pula, digiri, ino kuno kiri bi para la pula por pasi, eno ese nu para kanaka. So what you mean? Sapra o para kai thai kena lukulu kori ko pepe pini. Kori kame choke no man kohi de nha lukulu pepe kori se hapi. Ora mi sono sapere il carattere che si chiama Pablo Capocco, lo siamo lasciato. Però ti mi ha con il gruppo del carro. Di col gruppo. E se noi non ti davo, e poi io ho il carro se mi prega. Se io non ho il carro posso andare a passare.
The first time we go in there, curious and frightened. That was the first reaction. The second time we go in, they say, here they come again. And when did all that treasure get to our hands this time? Because most of the people wanted the trade to get more knives and axes and things which they didn't have. And you can imagine the difference between a stone tomahawk and a good steel tomahawk. So they were very, very anxious to get the trade. And they thought we were weak and we couldn't protect it. And so they said, we'll get them in. Next time they come, we'll get them in. They can sleep here. And we kill them up and take their gear off. We'll have all those axes and all those knives and all those gallery shells and all that small trade. That would be attitude. The first thing we try to do to let them see that we weren't unarmed, we were armed, and we had good weapons. And we say, well, now we don't want any trouble when they look like attacking. And we do the same to you as we did to the pig, because we've got the guns to do it.
You leave our stuff alone, we leave your stuff alone. We're just looking for these stones in the creek beds as we go along. That's all we came to look for.
And one or two occasions they go up and said, well, the poor old pig can't dodge like we can. It really took a bit away from the power of the gun.
Some of the man brandy And I think nine parallel is shooting now. Party.
All we did, and I think it was quite right, was to save our lives and the 90 carriers who went with them. Because once we, my brother and I, lost our lives, that would have been definitely the end of all the carriers that we had. They would have been killed out of hand. It would have been a mass slaughter. And we, and as the big chief, he said in his address, when we come there and traveled it down and he told us the whole story, he said that he said to them, they've got all these wonderful things that we need, axes and knives and shell. Look at the shell, look at the things that they have. They can't fight like we can. All we can do, all we've got to do is to go and just take it off them. Now when I kill the first one of these white men, when I throw the spear through and spear the white men, you dive, rush in and grab the people, kill them, and we'll take, this will be all ours. Well, as he went to throw the spear, Mick shot, but as the whole mob rushed, so did all the Boyce guns fire. Well, there was only one shot fired, and there was a terrific barrage when the whole, there was about 15 guns or more went off.
My marine army in the bay, they were in the jail. Oh, but I made it by I made a man.
Well, it was the order of the day, I suppose. The government allowed you to do it. And anybody who got killed or wounded, you had to put a report in and that had to be investigated. It wasn't a matter of going along and killing someone. And no investigation made, there had to be a government investigation made behind it. There was no such a thing as you just killing someone and that's the end of it.
The administration's attitude was a lot of the people, they didn't know much about those things. We never reported those things that happened. I mean, it was just one of the things that happened on the trip. But that was a rare occasion, and had we been killed on that trip, there would have been, we had about 90 carriers with us, and they were all foreign people to these. Well, they would have been all wiped out too.
Soon after their flight, the Leys walked into this valley and here at last they discovered gold. They set up their final base camp, surrounded by 250,000 more people whose existence had not even been suspected by the outside world.
There was not so many on the first day, but the next day there was a big crowd arrived. They're all in one long line, and they come in with their food and their sugar cane and the stuff like that, and to show that they were friendly and they wanted to trade with us. But I think they did think that we were something a bit more than ordinary human beings.
Oh, we're going to go to the house. We're going to go to the house. We're going to go to the house. The pilot Kavansky was a very tall man, about 6'1" or 2, and he had a flying suit and a white helmet with his bad goggles. And he got out of the plane, then he opened the door, and Kingsbury was going to just take it out the inside of the plane. There must have been 2,000 or 3,000 natives lined up along the airstrip. And they were absolutely amazed, the people, and just looked up with wonderment. They didn't know what next was going to happen.
They used to come and look back for weeks out and see this picking of it.
excellent for us.
There was a big tribal war not very long before we arrived, and the people that lived on that land were scattered from one end of the Hagen area to the other. So it was a no man's land when we got it. There was no owners to it. And the people who chased the rightful owners from the country, well, they said we could go ahead and mine there. And the prospects were very good, and we got pieces of gold to about 10 grains in weight, which is very good. The best prospect we had struck in all our trips. So we had to wait till the geologists came out, and the engineers came out from well to examine it. It was quite wonderful, really, the thought of what we might get, because the Eldorado was always at the end of our trip.
Mick decided that one of them should go down and see what how we did live down there, that we weren't all walking around guarding guns and protecting ourselves and all that. So we spoke to the commander and said, what about coming? And they said, no, we won't go. But in the end, they allowed one of the kids to go.
You want to order something? Why did they come here? Hey, Mr. Maria. Let me show you some top resin for a cafe. Now you know what you do. You stop a mountain and hang in the Nika branch of the Kirina and Tawaj and Matadeni. Every number one was for Romania. Now you put a book in the area and people are missing in this town. You want to get out of it? What do you want to see me in here?
Mamina.
Okay. Now you have me, I do want to look in here. What's the money now? This is in this branch. Ele disse me livre! Mas também que ele disse me na puta me roubar hoje, nem choque me nascer no matento. Ele não vai no puta cara, vou lá de tu pra chitar no mate. Ora que não mata, se já não, não tu pra chitar no mate. Ô mamá Romina, papá Romina, eu estou com você, bom, papá Romina, me foi um dia, me disse nem com o filho. Não, estou no meu, você. Aí se não, estou junto com ele, cai, cai. Me put on the wall, me look in Chapra House, clean the house, Chapra Lepra House, Chapra Webra House. Nothing to me from here, so I'll make a number of pressure with every now by me worry. Me also now, me keeping you my mother me now, me crying to it.
And he took it out of the ocean, and salt was the thing that they're always short of up in the highlands. And then he said, well, taste it. And the boy tasted it, and then he said, get me some bottles, and I'll fill them up. They found out bottles. So he filled up some bottles of water and tied them up because he wanted to take them back, because he said, when I go back, they won't believe me to so much of this. Well, then he saw a horse, a young, small horse, and he said, pig, pig. So they said, I know horse, well, he'd never heard of a horse before. So he said, well, give me a bit of its tail and a bit of it here and there. So as I can say, well, look, here it is, and here's a bit of it, you see. So he got a bit of that. And the same with every, when he went to do his shop, he'd take things, because he didn't know anything about paying or buying or anything like that. So they said, well, give it to him. And so, of course, he landed back eventually after 4 or 5 days. They didn't keep him there very long, because they wanted to get him back whole, or otherwise it could have been very nasty if he hadn't got back. And when he got back, he had all these things, you see, and he's had, he started to tell them. And he said, there's a barless, he said, this one has only got one here, but he said, there's one down there, it's got one zzzz, and one zzzz, and one further there. And he said, there's pigs as big as this, and you know, the solid, you know, as far as the eye can see, you know, it's full of water, full of salt, and, you know, tasted it, and you know, the lap clothing and things like that, you know, plenty of it. And nobody has a gun, they all walk about, and everybody's sort of friendly. And because they didn't believe in them, they said, oh, it can't be that good. So they all wanted to get in the fun. Well, they were real bush canakers, and they were very primitive. They had never worked at any job before. See, it was always hard to get labour for plantations and mining on the coast, but for mining in the highlands, where there was only one miner, well, it wouldn't be hard to get them. There'd be hundreds of applications for a few jobs.
People, we're going to get it possible. We're going to get it possible. We're going to get it possible.
It's getting close to the end, and what we'd like to do is make sure that we have an opportunity just to say something about what's in that film, because I think that's important. We have about 10 minutes left, don't we? Something like that?
15.
15?
Well, 10 maybe we have to leave it.
Yeah, I think, do you have any kind of feelings about what that film is saying and the kind of impressions that you have? Do you have a good feeling with seeing some of those things, or what kind of...
I'd like to ask just what's the difference between, say, this sort of contact and the contact that missionaries would have, or native evangelists?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a part of the point of the whole thing too, in terms of
this is kind of a business
business proposition. I'm here, and then one of the lay brothers said, he said, I'm here because I'm here for Mick Lay, and I'm going to get what I can out of it, and then I'm going to get back to Australia and talk where everybody can understand me. Actually, the Lays stayed, all of them, pretty much in PNG for a long time, and were very wealthy people because they started stores and all kinds of things that benefited them tremendously. And some of those projects are still going with their family. One of the daughters still runs a big artifact store in Leh, which was one of the big wartime areas during the Second World War. But I think, Ralph, you have precisely the point, I think, of what some of this says, is the methodology, the strategy, in terms of how missionaries, and not just missionaries, but other people too. You can't lump people into groups, but I think there was a definite difference in the means of contact and an approach that, like in the last part, perhaps, what he had said was, well, these people never did any labor before, which is really true or false.
They had to labor to live.
Yeah, exactly, very hard. And for all of those 90 carriers to move all of that cargo from one place to another for the Lays was certainly an act of labor too. I mean, there was nothing easy about that one, especially. But of course, the significance too of that, and it really is a kind of a dramatic thing, that nobody had ever been in those areas before. I mean, that really was the first time that people went in that way and took that kind of a photographic record.
What was the year about that contact would have been made? This...
Well, 1930 is...
1930, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they progressively went back again to capitalize on the gains they had first of all made. Does that answer your question, Ralph, or do you want...
Well, no, not quite. Here we saw, you know, what they're doing, the trip through, and also bringing in the airfield and starting gold mining. Now, how did they start the missions? How did they make contact with them? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Okay.
How do you spread Christianity in a place like that? Or how did they, I mean?
Okay, well, I think that once hearing, I think what you're saying, following that, when things were opened up, and of course, the government usually then after that made certain, before any other further contact was made with people, that it was a safe area for people to go into.
So the missions came after these
people? After these people, okay. When the government had said, this is a safe place. One of the places where we lived and worked in the Inga part, which is not far from the Hagen area, I mean, it would be another, well, by air it would be about 25 minutes, but by road at that time was 6 or 7 to 10 hours. In that area, it was probably 1951. When some of the areas were declared by the government, this area has been pacified and you can now go in. And in one area where we were, it was 49 when the first metal axe was found, and actually that was found by the people themselves, who knew during the war that one of the planes, an Allied plane, had crashed in their area and went up and took metal out of it. And when the people came in, when the Australian patrol officers came in, they found people with metal axes that they had shaped themselves. And that was a fairly ingenious kind of a thing to do too. And by the way, they had even taken the people in the plane and given them a proper burial as well, which indicates that there was certainly a lot of, you know, certainly some cross-cultural concern on their part too. And but it varied according to areas as to when the government felt it was appropriate, then the church could go in. And probably the latest area was 62 or 63 in the Highlands. Yes.
One thought I had as we were watching this is that the missionary wouldn't have been so free to use his guns like these guys did to establish himself. I suspect a missionary going in at that time would have been killed.
Yeah, and there were deaths.
But not necessarily. It depended. The next, or the film we showed previous to that, it was a few years later, but they also went into areas they were armed. The Jim Taylor, who was a representative of the government, but his point was he didn't want to kill anybody. He wanted them to realize that these people were not defenseless. They could defend themselves, but his point was not to kill people if he could at any cost avoid it. And I think this was the mission emphasis too. If you could avoid being killed by the people just because out of fear and not knowing who you were, that was far better. And they did make patrols without losses of life. In one of these areas, he said they shot just all around. I don't know if you were getting that idea. He was saying they were going all around, and he was saying that the people were shooting with their guns just every direction you were. But this didn't happen on most of the patrols that happened. That was not their policy to do it, and mission was also the same way. So very much so. And I wouldn't agree necessarily that they went and killed.
No, maybe I misunderstood what you were saying.
No, I didn't say that.
Okay. No.
We do have different opinions.
No, I don't think that's what I was saying in answer to that question.
What about today? Are we going into safe areas anymore, or have we, meaning the church, are they still going out into some of these areas that have never seen white people, or is that
now? Yeah, that's really in the past tense. But I think, you know, here's where we come to the conflict of cultures, cross-cultural conflict. And now the dangers are not from people who have never seen another expatriate, but it's possibly from the fact that not only amongst expatriates, but Papua New Guinean to Papua New Guinean, violence and the use of force and that...